You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, a Malaysia Airlines passenger plane carrying almost 300 people has crashed near Ukraine's border with Russia. We'll have the very latest. Also coming up,
the Israeli people and the Palestinian people don't want to live like this. They deserve to live in peace and security, free from fear. And that's why we're going to continue to encourage diplomatic efforts to restore the ceasefire. And we support Egypt's continued efforts to bring this about.
A momentary ceasefire is observed in Gaza, but a longer-term peace plan is a long way off. The defence editor for the Evening Standard, Robert Fox, and Jane Kinnamont of Chatham House will join me to discuss that and the rest of the day's stories, from Iran to US sanctions to the UAE's plans for Mars. Then, as the RIBA releases its Sterling Prize shortlist, we'll examine which buildings had advanced the industry more than others. All that, plus our culture editor, Robert Bound, reviews the best of the week's book releases, and our man in Istanbul, Joseph Dana, will report on the latest news from Turkey. That's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. And to begin, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news from around the world.
A passenger plane with 295 people on board has been shot down as it flew above eastern Ukraine, an area where pro-Russian separatist rebels have been fighting Ukrainian government forces. The Malaysian Airlines Boeing 777 was flying from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur and was brought down by Buk ground-to-air missile, an advisor to the Ukrainian Interior Ministry said. The advisor said the 280 passengers and 15 crew members are all believed to have died. Officials in Ukraine denied the country's armed forces were involved in the shooting down of the plane. A convoy of 50 trucks carrying humanitarian aid from Kuwait has arrived in Iraq to help refugees fleeing violence in Iraq's northern provinces. The news comes as Antonio Guterres, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, appealed to the international community to help it cope with the enormous challenge of assisting and protecting over a million refugees, both Syrian and Iraqi, who have fled the fighting.
There is no humanitarian solution for this crisis. The solution is political. And my appeal to all Iraqi political leaders is to come together, to overcome differences, to overcome contradictions, and to be able to find a solution that reunites the Iraqi people.
Several shells have hit the terminal of Libya's main airport in Tripoli today as fighting between rival militias for control continued for a fifth day. Rival militias have been fighting since Sunday for control of the airport as the political turmoil in the North African oil producer worsens. Talking of oil, a Chinese oil rig has finished drilling near the disputed Paracel Islands in the South China Sea after finding signs of oil and gas and is being moved away from the area more than 2 months after its deployment damaged relations with Vietnam. The Vietnamese Coast Guard said the $1 billion rig had been towed from contested waters. The rig's relocation could reduce tensions between the two neighbours after one of the worst breakdowns in ties since they fought a brief war in 1979. Its removal was also welcomed by Washington and the US State Department's Jen Psaki.
The oil rig incident has highlighted the need for claimants to clarify their claims in accordance with international law, to reach a shared understanding on appropriate behavior and activities in disputed areas. We support relevant parties adopting a voluntary freeze on provocative unilateral actions in support of further implementation of the 2002 Code of Conduct.
Explosions were seen over Gaza from the border with Israel on Thursday as a temporary five-hour truce came to an end. A spokesman for the Islamist Hamas rulers of Gaza denied initial comments by an Israeli official that a full ceasefire was expected to start at 6 a.m. on Friday. Since the conflict started last week, Gaza health officials say at least 224 Palestinians, mostly civilians, have been killed. In Israel, one civilian has been killed with 1,300 rockets launched into the Jewish nation. And finally, with temperatures expected to hit 90 Fahrenheit, 32 degrees tomorrow here in England. Over in the United States, a severe drought is plaguing California for a third year. But some residents and businesses are looking beyond the help of Mother Nature to provide care for their lawns. Green Canary is a company that turns dull, water-deprived grass into lawns that look lush and bright, green thanks to paint. Its president, Sean Shabari, said that the water-based paint is pet-friendly and has been used in various places, including golf courses and soccer fields.
We have had successes in cemeteries where they're cutting back significantly on the cutting of the lawn, and they still need to keep it green for the site.
And that's the latest news here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this. ...1806 in London, 1306 in New York City. We begin with some breaking news, as you heard at the top of the programme. A Malaysia Airlines plane has crashed on the Russia-Ukraine border near the eastern city of Donetsk. At the moment, we have no definitive evidence as to what has caused the crash, although the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is saying that they believe it was shot down. They are so far providing no evidence to prove that. Tristan McAllister is Monocle's transport editor. Before we get into the speculation, which frankly I really want to try and avoid, what do we know so far, Tristan?
Well, what we do know, Steve, much to what you said, is that the plane did go down somewhere just near the Russia-Ukraine border on the Ukrainian side. What we're now seeing on all the news wires and other places that there are photographs emerging from certain sites around, in that area, debris, and then other things related to the accident now. Or the incident. Malaysia Airlines, of course, has said that they know that their plane is missing, and it's now been pretty much visually confirmed that it was the Malaysia Airlines jet.
Now, this is a Boeing 777. We believe it was somewhere between 33 and 40,000 feet cruising altitude. How could it come down? What are the possibilities?
Well, I'm sort of with you on this one. The conjecture is always a difficult thing in these situations. What I will say is that it does look like there was something that took it apart in air. It doesn't look like the impact to the ground is what took the airplane apart, because you're seeing disparate parts of it strewn out across an area. At least that's the way it's sort of coming together. So the thought would be that either something surface to air, like a missile, which is what we're hearing could have been the case, or some sort of rapid decompression on board that could have been a bomb. Now, that's an extreme likelihood in this situation, because no one is, of course, saying that. But what is seeming very clear at this point is that both the Ukrainians and the Russians are taking it as an opportunity to sort of point fingers, and that's sort of where the narrative seems to be going.
One final word on Malaysia Airlines itself, obviously coming so quickly after what happened, and we still don't know exactly what happened with MH370. How had Malaysia Airlines moved on from that last tragedy?
I think move on is a really interesting term. I don't even think it's the right way to say it, because we still have no closure from MH370. I was looking at some data earlier this week, because of course the Farnborough Air Show was on this week here in the UK, and this year had been one of the safest years in aviation history, because they weren't able to claim MH370 as an accident yet. They don't know what happened to it. So it's still very much looming in our minds. So now to have MH17, another sort of mainstay of the narrative in the news, can't be good.
Tristan McAllister, Monocle's transport editor, thank you. We will, of course, be providing more coverage on this story on tonight's Monocle Daily. That's at 2200 hours. For now, though, you're listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Joining me now with their take on the rest of the day's big stories are Robert Fox, defence editor for the Evening Standard, and Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House, his Middle East and North Africa programme. Welcome both. Let's begin by looking at the situation in Israel and Palestine. Despite a momentary humanitarian ceasefire brokered by the UN, the situation in Gaza looks ever worse. According to Gazan health officials, at least 220 Palestinians, mostly civilians, have been killed so far by Israeli strikes, including, of course, four Palestinian boys on Wednesday who are playing on a beach in Gaza City. A longer ceasefire is yet to be successfully brokered, but talks in Egypt are proceeding. Jane Kinnamont, we're in a very delicate situation. There are negotiations that appear to be going on. The reasons why Hamas had been said they were unhappy about the previous ceasefire suggestion was that they weren't involved in the talks brokered by Egypt, that this had been presented to them as a fait accompli. Has that situation changed now?
Well, there's a very deep distrust between Hamas and the government of Egypt. Indeed, some months ago, there were Egyptian security officials telling reporters that they were going to sponsor an uprising in Gaza against Hamas, following the model of the uprising against the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. There's no love lost there. And the other interlocutor with the international community is the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, who Hamas also fundamentally don't trust.
Robert Fox, no one trusts anyone. Where do we go from here?
I don't think both sides are, by that I mean the Netanyahu government and his military particularly, which is so interesting. Hearing the remarks from the Southern District Commander of the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and the Hamas leadership, they're not ready for a ceasefire yet. They want to fight on some more, because ceasefire in both lexicons, in both the agenda of the Israel government and Hamas, means them losing too much. I know Jane probably knows more about this in detail than I do, but what I suspect is that, yes, there's no love lost. It's a very easy algebraic sum. Hamas clings to the ethos, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Sisi regime in Egypt is the enemy of the Muslim Brotherhood, so they're going to mistrust them anyway. And they suspect that they want them to give away the ranch, which is not only missile technology and what they're doing with their rocketry, but also, even more vital, is the routes in, the tunneling systems and so on. They do not trust the Egyptians. They do not trust Abbas on that. Israel, it seems to me, and this is purely the military observation, and I'll get emails from Israeli embassies around the world for saying this, but Israel thinks tactically. It is not thinking strategically. It is not thinking what it does with an incursion. Yes, we're going to smash up rocket sites, we're going to do this, cause a lot of mayhem, lose a lot of cred in world opinion again, which they are losing very badly at the moment. I get emails every day, will you come and get a briefing from various representatives, actually the Israeli government itself. They are beginning to realize they're losing the propaganda war. But by going in, what are they going to do? They're going to do the same operation. They want it to be quick and dirty. It's going to be slow and dirty, because what they're faced with is the prospect of occupation. That, even in part, that is something that Israel's public will not sustain over a matter of weeks. And then I won't go out wider, but I hope we do in this discussion, then you've got to look at the regional context, which is looking extremely ominous now.
We can look at that in a moment. Jane, I just want to pick up on this issue of what Israel thinks it can gain from continuing with this operation. What is its short end game?
I mean, this is deja vu. It's only in late 2012 that we saw something very similar flare up, but at that point it stopped shorter. There was a ceasefire negotiated more quickly. Essentially, there's an attempt going on to get deterrence. That's what Israel hopes that it can do. It hopes that it can teach Hamas a lesson that and also that the civilian population in Gaza will increasingly turn against Hamas and hold Hamas responsible, seeing the rocket attacks as what has brought this down upon them. There's
that worked really well last time and the time before, didn't it?
It really is history repeating itself. There's a book about to come out by a French academic, Jean-Paul Filou, with Oxford University Press, which looks at a history of Gaza going back for centuries. And certainly the history of Gaza since the occupation by Israel began is incredibly depressingly repetitive.
Robert Fox, let's look at that sort of broader context sort of within the region now, because, you know, we've got this situation in Palestine where we had until recently a separate leadership in the West Bank and in Gaza. Then they had this unity government. There was also some sort of peace process. At least you had two sides sitting down talking. We now have none of that. There's not much of a unity government either. There's not much of a support for the Palestinians now from Egypt anymore. When you look at that broader regional situation, are there any signs of hope?
Well, I hope is a very, very fragile flower in all of this. But the depiction that you give, which is depressing, and it's absolutely right, because what you have got, you know, the negotiations were going to lead to a two-state solution. Actually, what people like David or Lieberman, the foreign minister, really seem to want, as far as I know, is a non-two-state solution. Mm. You have got Israel, the state, and then you've got two non-states, in the West Bank and in Gaza. Now, here's the curveball. You throw into that what is going on immediately in Syria and Iraq and ISIS, which is getting closer, either metaphorically or physically, to the Jordanian border. What you may get in virtual terms is a link-up between ISIS, or the caliphate as it now is, which is incredibly viral in social media and so on, with the Hamas cause. Now, this is going to start something else. Physically on the ground, the most vulnerable point actually is not Gaza itself. God knows what those people have been through, and they'll go through it again, I'm very sorry to say. I think the most vulnerable aspect, which has got the nerves jangling in Western capitals, not least London and Washington, is Jordan now. And that the fact is that I think this is why the normal sponsors of Israel, including Obama's Washington, is getting fed up with this, because this is making life even more unstable. Kerry has tried harder than anybody for two secretaries of state, even more than Hillary Clinton, to get this deal going. There is no deal on the table. There are so many spoilers going in on the Israeli side. But the fact is that nature abhors a vacuum and the Middle East abhors stasis. This is on the move. The carpet is creeping.
Jane, how worried would you be for Jordan?
This issue of support for jihadis is a problem for Jordan. The latest Pew Global Attitude surveys found that in most countries you've got very low support for jihadi groups, but that the support is highest in Palestine and in Jordan. That said, they have been able to maintain stability despite a lot of predictions that they'd face very severe problems since 2011. They have got very, very strong Western support, which helps them to do that.
I want to move on now to another big topic in the Middle East, and this one I hope we can be slightly more optimistic about, perhaps, and that's the talks currently going on in Vienna between Iran and the so-called P5 plus one groups of nations. That's the permanent five at the Security Council plus Germany. The main players, of course, being Iran and the US. John Kerry and the Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif are still hoping to secure a deal by Sunday, Robert Fox. And if this does come off, if, this could actually be a very big deal indeed, couldn't it?
I think it's going to be quite a push to get it by Sunday. There's so much opposition to it, because, but particularly that this is why strategically, to say again what Israel is up to in Gaza is so unwise, because it's like a seesaw. It's one thing up and one thing down. I remember at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, which is probably just before you were born, says he, being patronising, that there was a wonderful cartoon in The Guardian saying that it was a seesaw, one of those children's seesaws, with Kennedy with the tiger skin beating his chest, missile crisis at one end and Berlin in the other, because he lost out on Berlin. Similarly, Israel, whatever it's doing in Gaza, It has got world opinion's eye off the ball now with Iran, and Iran is about to gain very, very strongly because there is a consensus in the negotiating team. We really need Iran. We really need Iran for the resolution of a whole string of crises across the region.
Jane, how likely... let's move on from how likely there is to be a deal. If it does happen, let's be optimistic. What will it actually mean for Iran and the wider region?
I think Iran does want a deal because the nuclear program has always been a means to a variety of ends, international prestige, international acceptance and so forth. And it will be cheered by the fact that it's more obvious than ever before that Iran and the US are on the same side when it comes to Iraq, essentially fighting for the same government. They will be hoping that they are accepted as a key power in many parts of the region. But of course, Israel, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states are lobbying very, very hard to make sure that Iran doesn't become seen as part of the solution, especially in places like Syria, where it has been complicit in war crimes.
We're going to have to leave it there for just a moment. We'll be back in a minute with Jane Kinnamont and Robert Fox. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guests tonight, Robert Fox of the Evening Standard and Jane Kinnamont of Chatham House. Now, in response to Russia's alleged support of the pro-separatist forces in the east of Ukraine, the American government has announced new sanctions against Moscow, targeting oil giant Rosneft, as well as the energy, financial and defence sectors. Analysts predict that the measures will really impact Russia when the EU gets on board. Robert, we can obviously, given what's happened in the past few hours, we can't really ignore that, even if we don't quite know what's going on at the moment. But all of a sudden, sanctions and Russia's involvement in east of Ukraine, it's been on the back burner for a couple of months, but it's back with a vengeance.
Steve, you couldn't be more right. It's now on the headlines, where we've been preoccupied for various reasons with ISIS and the caliphate and what's been going on there, the subjects that we've been talking about. The fate of the Malaysian, whatever it is, how it came down, the Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 from Amsterdam, now puts this absolutely right up at the top of the agenda again, because they have got to have some discussion with Russia about what really went on. I think that if it has been a worst-case scenario and this has been a warlike act, inadvertent, by either side, it's probably going to be very, very difficult forensically to get at the truth, because people, such things have happened in the past. Think of the downing of the Polish aircraft with the Polish leadership aboard. We never fully got to the bottom of that. But the way Putin has been reacting to this, he knows, and this is where he is a world player. He knows this is very, very serious indeed, and he has got to address this. And I think that probably the sanctions thing will come up much later now, because Germany must be resisting that like crazy.
Well, indeed, Jane, it's all very well the US announcing sanctions, but there are two other things here. One that's not happening, which is the EU coming on board, and as Robert points out, Germany's not very keen. Italy's foreign minister, who may end up being the new EU foreign policy chief. Not that many in Eastern Europe would be very happy about that. They're not keen on sanctions with Russia. And also, let's not forget, in the last two or three days, we've had the new development bank, this BRICS bank, being created, which is, again, partly Russia trying to say to the rest of the world or to the West, bring on all these sanctions all you want, we don't need you.
Well, it's predictable. The US is in a position to do this because it's on the road to energy self-sufficiency. A lot of European countries still need to import natural gas, and you're seeing not only the new entrants like Bulgaria and Romania signing deals with Russia, but major established countries like Austria. The EU can't afford these kinds of sanctions. It doesn't mean they're not worth doing.
Okay. The President of France, François Hollande, begins a tour of West Africa, Niger, Chad and the Ivory Coast today, reviving his France-Afrique policy. Not really his policy, it's been at France's for many, many decades. Robert Fox, however much French presidents come in saying they want to change their relationship with Africa, it always reverts to support for the strong man, and we'll have our military there where we want it.
Whether it's right or left, you still get the sentimental harking to the Francophonie, the French-speaking area. There's a lot of sentiment, there's a lot of hard fact, and there's a lot of real danger there, because this is where I do have sympathy for François Hollande, Nicolas Sarkozy, and it goes back to Giscard d'Estaing. This is the backyard. And it relates to your previous question and answer. This is Europe's backyard. And the way that what is going on in America, by the way, with all of this, and it relates to Africa, but I would like to relate it to the previous question, is that there is a suspicion on the part of the Europeans, and I think it's not entirely unfounded, that even Obama is playing domestic US politics with this, to look macho and tough. I mean, the Cheneys, you would have thought it's like Dracula coming out of the coffin again. The Cheneys and the Wolfowitzes are reappearing, the Vulcans, the neocons. You've got to stand up to these people. It does not face the reality of where the wider European neighbourhood is. It goes out to the Gulf, it goes through the Crimea, and it goes into Eastern Europe, and it goes to sub-Saharan Africa. This is a major point of interest. This is probably a rather cack-handed or inept, should I put, effort, because it harks back to the Francophonie, but what Hollande is doing is really a little bit of soft power. But what he knows, the governments who are really scared across this belt of sub-Saharan Africa, they want a lot of assistance of hard power, and it can't only be France. It's got to be Britain and Italy as well.
And Jane, it's definitely hard power, not soft power, isn't it, when we look at France's relationship with West Africa in terms of what they've been doing in recent years, whether that's going into Mali or Central African Republic, or even with hosting heads of state summits in Paris for Nigeria and other heads of states, looking at what to do with Boko Haram.
There's soft power to back it up. There's rising levels of trade between France and Africa, totaling about $70 billion per year in both directions. But the military interventions do underline the way that the colonial period still shapes and defines what's happening in North Africa today.
And just finally, while obviously we've been talking about less impressive things in the Arab world, let's have one ray of light, and that's that the United Arab Emirates is allegedly joining the space race. A new space agency has been created with a mission of touching down on Mars by 2021. Rather ambitious, I must say. I remember once being in Nigeria and driving past the Nigerian Space Agency, the Obasanjo Space Centre, it was called. Nigeria didn't have much luck actually getting much into space. Jane, do you think the UAE is going to get to Mars within the next 7 years?
7 years is ambitious, but they've got the money. They, in the Gulf, usually it's best to at least double the timelines that people set out. But it's something that could happen. But I feel rather sorry again for the Malaysians here. The UAE has been saying that this is the first Islamic space programme. And of course, the Malaysians have had one for several years, which was assisted very heavily by the Russians. Perhaps not something that we're going to see racing ahead in the immediate future.
Maybe not. Robert Fox, it's certainly ambitious, saying let's go to Mars in 2021. The PR is good. Is there much substance behind it?
We can all have a bit of a laugh about it, can't we? But actually what's going on underneath is very interesting and I think potentially extremely serious. UAE is building up its own arms industry. This is why they nixed a deal for new fighters, either for the Rafale from France or the Typhoon from UK, Germany and the consortium. Because what they wanted was a co-production deal to build drones. unmanned aircraft. Well, they've got it now. It's hardly been noted, but they took over Piaggio of Italy, famous for building the Vespa motor scooter. And by the way, Piaggio UAE, part of its great deal to the great UAE public, was if you buy a Piaggio Vespa in the UAE in Ramadan, you can have the insurance free for a year. But they are building, and they have already got working, their own mid-level, it's called a male, medium altitude, long endurance drone. That's what they wanted. It's quite primitive level, but it works. And it's an Italian model, and they are serious about it. They're pulling away from the West. Look at the way they pulled out of the Airbus deal. And they're saying, well, we'll think about buying aircraft from Boeing now. They are actually distancing themselves from the usual client-patron relationship with Europe.
Robert Fox, Defence Editor for the Evening Standard, and Jane Kinnamont from Chatham House. Thank you both very much for joining me on Midori House.
Thank you.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. In the next half hour, we'll take a look at the buildings that have made the RIBA Sterling shortlist. And Robert Bound will be here to tell us what books we should be reading. But first, here's Jonathan with the headlines.
Thank you very much. A passenger plane with 295 people on board has been shot down as it flew above eastern Ukraine, an area where pro-Russian separatist rebels have been fighting Ukrainian government forces. The Malaysian Airlines Boeing 777 was flying from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur and was brought down by a Buk ground-to-air missile. Several shells have hit the terminal of Libya's main airport today as fighting between rival militias for control of the airport continued for a fifth day. Explosions have been seen over Gaza from the border with Israel today. As a temporary five-hour truce came to an end, a spokesman for the Islamist Hamas rulers of Gaza denied initial comments by an Israeli official that a full ceasefire was expected to start at 6 a.m. on Friday. And a convoy of 50 trucks carrying humanitarian aid from Kuwait has arrived in Iraq to help refugees fleeing violence in Iraq's northern provinces. And for the moment, that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan Wheatley, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Time now for us to head to Istanbul for a roundup of the week's news in Turkey. Eastern Mediterranean correspondent Joseph Dana is standing by. Joseph, welcome to Midori House. Let us begin with one of the big stories in the region that's really affecting Turkey itself, and that's obviously what's happening across the border in Iraq. And there's been a whole series of reports about Turkey and, of course, ISIS.
Right. Well, the last week has been very, very busy in the region as a whole, especially with the Gaza crisis. And so kind of using that media cover that Gaza's provided, there's been a number of really significant developments in terms of Turkey's relationship with ISIS. Now, namely, the Turkish intelligence organization released the fact that two Turkish nationals have been known to be commanding ISIS operations in Iraq, and they might actually be involved in some of the kidnapping of Turkish nationals in Iraq. And so this is an incredibly important story reflecting just how deep Turkey is kind of involved in this ISIS group. The fact that there's Turkish nationals that are organizing operations on the ground really points to the fact that there could be some serious ISIS actions that actually take place on Turkish territory. And then another story kind of compounding that is the fact that a number of Shia mosques in Istanbul have been attacked in recent weeks. It's been kind of kept under the radar in the Turkish media, but now it's seeping out. And a couple of Turkish human rights organizations have actually claimed that that the attackers, the arsonists in this case, were actually ISIS militants. And so that means that ISIS is increasingly looking at Turkey and specifically Istanbul as a potential ground for further operations. And that would really create a massive problem for the Turks as well as for the international community and NATO forces in Turkey.
The unrest in Iraq has also posed another conundrum for Turkey, of course, which is that now the safest, best-run parts of the country are obviously Kurdish, and that's put the Turkish government in a bit of a position trying to work out how much it wants to support Kurdish autonomy inside Iraq, when obviously it doesn't really want the same inside Turkey.
Absolutely, and this is it's a long-going story. The recent violence from ISIS, or the recent takeover of Mosul by ISIS, has really just pushed it to the forefront. Turkey has increasingly warmed relations with the Kurdish regional government, specifically in the realms of energy. The Kurds have been exporting oil to Turkey that has been then kind of pushed through the Turkish territory out on into the Mediterranean, on into the international markets, and so we see this increasingly warm economic relationship developing exactly at the time, like you pointed out, in which Turkey still has an ongoing problem with its own Kurds. And the upcoming presidential election with Prime Minister Erdogan, we see that Erdogan is making a lot of overtures to perhaps a renewed effort to achieve some sort of peace agreement with the PKK, with the revolutionary Kurdish forces inside of Turkish territory. And so we can basically expect that Turkey is going to kind of continue to play this very odd role of kind of tacitly supporting Kurdish independence in northern Iraq, as well as trying to create some sort of situation in which it can, you know, arrive at a peaceful settlement for its own Kurdish issues, as it were. And just kind of tracking back to our first topic, there's actually been reports of ISIS militants hitting some targets inside of the Kurdish areas in northern Syria and pushing up against the Turkish border there. And so we're going to see increased cooperation between the Turkish intelligence forces and the Turkish army and the Kurds in northern Syria, which have basically created their own autonomous kind of region in that part of the country. And so it's a really pivotal and historic time for Kurdish Turkish relations, which sadly being overshadowed by other events in the region.
Now, as we're saying, this is obviously a volatile region at times for Turkey, but it's also a region that offers all sorts of economic opportunities. And Turkish Airlines is certainly a business that has been doing its best to try and take advantage of that. This week, they've announced that they think they're going to fly 60 million passengers this year. And they seem to be adding new routes all the time, Joseph.
It's really incredible to see. I mean, every time I visit Atatürk International, the sheer number of passengers that are flowing through the airport just never seems to end, really. And so we see these very encouraging numbers coming from Turkish Airlines this week, and primarily their growth areas seem to be in Eastern Asia as well as Africa, in which they're continuing to develop a huge network throughout Africa, effectively placing Istanbul as an African transit hub. At the same time, there's the third airport in Istanbul, which has been a very, very hot political issue in Turkey over the last year, but is going forward. Specifically, the political issues kind of pertain to the rapid urbanization of Istanbul as a whole, and the fact that a number of the kind of wooded areas in Istanbul will be destroyed to make way for this airport, and the fact that the price tag for this airport is something like $35 billion. But Turkish Airlines seems to be very confident that the creation of this new airport will not only increase their ability to bring more and more passengers through Istanbul, but also increase a certain international attractiveness for the city, and we'll see new airlines starting to use Istanbul as their transit hub as well. But really, the growth of Turkish Airlines is not skipping a beat, and it still is a very successful story when it comes to the aviation industry as a whole.
Joseph Dana in Istanbul, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Puerto Rico is struggling with a faltering economy and an ongoing debate over its status as a U.S. territory. Monocle Films meets the Puerto Ricans attempting to rethink the island's future.
Since we are a country without a nation, without a structured state, I believe that we have wasted a lot of our time in fighting. We do not have consensus regarding our history, and that is also what makes it interesting.
A cinematic portrait of the newfound pride in Puerto Rico, now showing in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, every year, the Royal Institute of British Architects awards its Stirling Prize to the architects of a building that has advanced the sector more than any other. The shortlist for the 2014 selection has been released, and it includes Birmingham City Library, the London Aquatic Centre of Olympics fame, and many others, including the Shard in central London. To discuss the shortlist and other buildings pushing the boundaries in architecture, not least in the capital, I'm joined now in the studio by Monocle's design editor, Tom Morris, and by Peter Rees, Professor of Places and City Planning at University College London and former Chief Planning Officer of the City of London. Welcome to you both. Peter, if I can begin with you, the Shard is the one that really stands out on this list. And we've been arguing about this within the office about whether the Shard is a good building or a bad building, I think pretty much since it first was mooted. Where do you stand on the Shard?
Lovely object in the wrong place. Beautiful thing to look at. Not necessary for anything, because there are three different uses joined together to produce enough space to be accommodated within this giant structure. And it's attempting to make London Bridge something it isn't, a centre of attraction.
It's London Bridge is not a centre of attraction.
It's a sign of a giant inferiority complex. The good thing is it tells you when you're nearly in the city.
That is true. I mean, Tom Morris, this is... You know, to repeat an argument we've been having off air, this building is pretty much everything that is wrong with modern day capitalism, isn't it? It's completely ruined the city.
I wouldn't say it's ruined the city at all. I think what it stands for, and obviously the investment behind it, where the money's come from, and it is it's an icon of, you know, this capitalist push in the city. But I don't know, I'm a huge fan of it, and I actually disagree with you, Peter. I like the fact that it sort of stands alone. I think it's the most kind of handsome. When it first went up, I had huge reservations about it, but actually the longer it's been there, and you know, you walk along the South Bank or cross a bridge in the evening, the way the light bounces off of it, I find it just incredibly striking. And I do find that whether you like it or not, I think, you know, skylines should say something of the history of a city. And I think we look back in 30 years, it will be a strange trace of a very strange time in London's history.
I didn't say I didn't actually like it. it's strange. What I said was it wasn't necessary. But now that we've got it, it is a beautiful object. Over 10% of it is completely useless at the top. It's pure architecture. And it's interesting, as buildings get tall around the world, the percentage of the building that's unused and is purely architectural expression at the top increases. Mm. But it is a beautiful object, I accept that, and I think it has become a worthwhile thing on the London skyline. One of the things that worries me most, though, is that it spawned an awful lot of tall buildings across London, which are not... as the Shard is partially useless. The buildings that are going up now are totally useless. They're piles of safety deposit boxes for offshore investment.
And far less beautiful.
Indeed. Whereas the trend we tried to start in the City of London years ago was to only build tall because we'd run out of space. Mm. So the cluster of towers around the Gherkin are there purely to provide the office floor space that people work in, and only because we'd run out of land to build what we call ground scrapers.
Mm-hmm. One undeniably beautiful building in London that's on this list is the is the Aquatic Centre by Zaha Hadid, which was obviously, we all saw 2 years ago during the Olympics, Tom, but that's when it had its water wings. They've been taken down. It's now a very lovely swimming pool.
Yeah, and that's one thing that's so interesting. It's in the list now because it was you know, well commented on the fact that it wasn't in the lineup 2 years ago. And now it's such, because, you know, all these six buildings on the list, they do all sort of have one combining trait, and that's they are sort of buildings for communities. And now that it's become a public swimming pool where people can use, and it's not just for athletes and sort of showing off to the world, you know, what London is and how much money London's got and what we can do for the Olympics, it's now, yeah, it's a functioning civic building. And I think that's why it's interesting it's on the list now.
And that's interesting, Peter, Tom's point there about many of these buildings being buildings for the community. There's the wonderful new library in Birmingham, which is, it's funny, I was there about 5 or 6 weeks ago on a Saturday, and it was absolutely packed with ordinary Brummies, in a way that a museum or an art gallery is often built to attract tourists and outsiders. This was a library built for the people that live there.
Indeed, they are all buildings to some extent for the public, and they're all buildings which in some ways are theatrical. The Shard is obviously theatrical, and you pay as much as you'd pay for a theatre seat in Liverpool to go up and just look at the view at the top. But it is a performance, very much the act of going to the building and either going to one of the restaurants or going up to the viewing gallery at the top. The Aquatic Centre is as much about performance as it is about the athletes that are training there. It's about watching as well, and the theatre and the library and the School of Art. It's the School of Art again, you know, I mean, art students love to pose, and what a wonderful space in which to pose and be pretentious. And then, of course, the student union at the LSE, you know, what a fantastic place to complete to get completely wasted. It's, with those sloping walls, they won't know whether they're upright or not.
Tom, what does this list tell you about the state of architecture in Britain at the moment?
Well, I think there's a huge variety. I think it's nice that, I mean, you know, half the buildings on the list are in London, half of them aren't, which is nice to see. I think in terms of, you know, a unifying aesthetic style, there isn't one. You can't really get any sense of, you can't test the waters to see, you know, what's going on in architecture at the moment stylistically, apart from, I was talking to Peter before, you know, there's a certain decorativeness to a couple of the buildings, particularly the one in Birmingham, that's, you know, quite interesting. But it's quite difficult to sort of come out with any conclusion about the state of architecture or the style of current architecture.
And Peter, is there anything that you feel is missing from this list that you would have liked to have seen highlighted?
I'm always concerned that the projects that make the shortlists for these prizes are the big glitzy schemes by the Starkitects. I remember judging a competition in Scotland for architectural awards a few years ago, and as the chairman, I was allowed to choose a project to give an award to, and I chose a little community garden in Glasgow in a derelict area where the local community had put something together in a place that would, on the face of it, had no hope at all. There's always something you can do to make a place better. Sadly, the smaller schemes tend not to rise to the surface in these sort of competitions. But then, you know, this is a competition for Starkitects, we have to admit it. And some of them, I think, are very practical. I'm putting my money on the Manchester School of Art because it's honest use of materials, it's sustainable because it's reusing an existing building, and it's going to have life in it, and it's going to get knocked about by the students. It's not a precious building.
Tom Morris, if you had to choose one that you'd like to see take away the prize?
Well, I know it'd be boring to agree with Peter, but I do. I think it's a great building. It's beautiful. It's an amazing sort of reuse of an old structure. And it's clever and it's modest. But I doubt it will win.
What do we think will win then?
I suspect it's going to be a Zaha or a Renzo.
Or I think possibly the Birmingham Library, which I think would be my second choice. I think it's a lovely... you've about it as well.
I'm a big fan of the library, even if it did take 10 years for them to finally build it. And actually, I really liked the old Central Library in Birmingham, which is an absolute design monstrosity, but was right in the heart of town. So people, it wasn't a destination. People walked through it. They went past it on the way to somewhere else, which I think a library should be. This one's a bit more of a destination, but still very beautiful. And I hope it wins.
And shouldn't we just say what a wonderful... indication of the health of British architecture to see such marvellous schemes
on the
list.
Absolutely, exactly.
There we are. Tom Morris, Monocle's design editor, and Peter Rees of University College London. Many thanks to you both. And we're going to stick to the building theme. This is the Commodore's Brick House. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Now, before the end of the show, it's time for us to review a few bits and bobs from the world of art. In fact, from the world of books. And Robert Bound is here.
Well, thanks for saving the best to last on Midori House this evening.
Well, you know, I thought, you know, all the other stuff was basically your warm-up act.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's how I like to think of it. I've got two books to talk about today, Steve. The first one is new from a British author, sort of a bit of a friend of Monocle, actually, Alex Preston. This is his third book. It's called In Love and War. It came out at the beginning of July. And it is a book set in Italy during the Second World War. And it's a love story. It's a coming-of-age story. And it's also a story about sort of where one's allegiances might lie. The star of the show is an aspiring young novelist called Esmond Lowndes. His father is one of the head honchos in the British Fascist Party, and he's gone out to set up a radio station for Mussolini.
Ah.
And that's where the parallels with Monocle 24 start and finish, I'd just like to point out. There's this terrible fascistic enterprise. Actually, I'll tell you what, with our logo, we could go, you know.
You reckon?
Let's not go there.
Let's not go there. So it's set in Florence in the 30s, and it's been getting some fantastic reviews, certainly in the British press over the last few days and weeks.
Yes, a lot of, I think it's been, it was sort of pre-reviewed, you know how these things work, quite a bit. And as I say, since it's come out, I think it seems to be doing very well, and it's kind of caught people's imaginations. Personally, when I was reading it, I didn't know a huge amount about Italy in the war. Clearly, a lot has been written about it and all the rest of it. It's sort of, I guess, Florence especially did that thing which kind of mixed the sort of the beauty of the old with the kind of the horror of the new and the horror of the war and all the rest of it. The way the book's put together is very interesting. It's done in the second person, and yet there's lots of sort of letters home and back and forth and all the rest of it, and radio transcripts and all the rest of it. So it's kind of, it does quite interesting things with the form of the novel.
How much of a departure is this for Alex Preston? I can't remember his second book, but his first novel, This Bleeding City, was a very good piece about the city of London, financial crisis. It was very current, very now. This obviously feels like it's a different beast.
Yeah, it is. The first one was definitely a sort of state of the nation sort of thing, or a state of what you know he actually used to do as a job before he was a novelist. And his second book was about a sort of like the Alpha Course, a thinly disguised novel about the Alpha Course and how middle class people can be driven mad into etc. by this sort of real or fake spirituality discussed sort of thing. This, I mean, it's a piece of historical fiction. There's a lot of research in it. Interestingly, I asked him about it. I think this interview is going to pop up on next week's Culture Show. And he said that he'd read, I think this is a book that we've both read as well, Steve, HHHH, the Laurent Binet book about Heydrich in the Second World War. Mm. And he sort of said, reading that, I wanted to put a fictional character in a historical context. So all the other characters in this book are real. So Mario Carita, one of the top sort of muscle men, sort of aggressors in Mussolini's fascist party, one of the sort of top black shirts, I guess, was, it stars in it, and he's sort of played off against our hero in this book. So yeah, it's an interesting thing, and it's definitely a departure for him. And I think it's his best book.
Okay, In Love and War by Alex Preston, and that is published by Faber. In the Beginning Was the Sea by Thomas Gonzalez.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing. This is a Colombian writer. It was written in the early 1980s. It takes place in the late 1970s. This is the reason we're talking about a book that was published in the early 1980s is this is the first publishing in English. It's published by the Pushkin Press, always reliable. If you're judging a book by the cover or by at least by the publisher's name on the spine, exactly, then these are your go-to publisher for sort of reliable foreign fiction that always, turn up some sort of interesting things. He's described as, if Garcia Marquez is Wagner, then Gonzalez is Bob Dylan. That's what they're going with. That's what the Pushkin Press are going with. Or maybe a reviewer did that. I think a Colombian reviewer, a Spanish language reviewer said that. And I can sort of see what they mean. It's kind of pithy. It's real. It's got sort of a beat quality to it somehow, actually. I'd be interested for a Spaniard to read it and for me to read it in English and see, or a Colombian to read it and see how the real and the translated versions, or the original and the translated versions, sort of play off against each other. I think it's a rollicking good story. It's a really interesting thing. It's sort of set on an island off the coast of, the nearest city is Medellin, but then the nearest big town is a place called Turbo, which I just love. I can't. How was last night? Well, I went to Turbo, but it's about a young sort of, it's about two young intellectual sort of idealists, a young couple, a guy and a girl, and they go to this desert island and buy this finca and sort of try to sort of have the, live the good life, as it were, which was a sort of, I guess, a popular thing that happened all over the world in the late 1970s. And it's about how they don't get on at the end.
And it's interesting as well how he talks about how he wrote it following the death of his brother and how that was his way of coping with the death of his brother, was to throw himself into his writing.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. And I think the protagonist in this, I think, is it's seen to be, I think reviewers have said that the protagonist in this is his brother, and he's putting himself in his brother's shoes. Reading it, you don't really get that idea. You get the idea of this slightly elliptical kind of main character. You never you never quite kind of know the main character, but you know all the characters that populate the book, which is a thing. That sounds to me very much like a lot of South American fiction, that there's a lot of detail, not in the sense of it being magic realism, but there's a lot of detail around the main character, but he sort of remains unknown to the reader somehow, apart from through his actions, if you know what I mean. But it's a really interesting read. I really recommend it. It's a beautifully done little book as well by Pushkin Press. I don't know when that comes out.
July.
That's out. There we are. Out this
later
month,
later so. On this month. Yeah. In the Beginning Was the Sea by Thomas Gonzalez, translated by Frank Wynne. That's out by Pushkin. And the other, of course, was In Love and War by Alex Preston. Robert Bound, thank you very much indeed.
You.
And Mr. Robert Bound brings us to the end of today's edition of Midori House. Don't forget that at 2200 hours, we will have more on the situation in Ukraine with the airliner, the Malaysia Airlines airliner, which has come down in Ukraine. More on that at 2200 hours with the Monocle Daily. My thanks, though, to our special guest today, the Defence Editor for the Evening Standard, Robert Fox, and Jane Kinnamont of Chatham House. Midori House was produced by Alad John, researched by Guy Lutz and Matilda Ivy. The studio manager was Joel Church. Jonathan Wheatley will be here with the headlines, and then following him, it'll be The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. Then, of course, it's The Daily later. Midori House, we're back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours London time, 1300 hours in New York City. My name's Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
London. Tell Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
At Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual Watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster Perpetual Watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.